I wasn't sure, but by the time we had trotted up the aisle, I saw that it was Wolf, beyond a doubt. I approached Wolf from behind and tapped him on the shoulder. When he spun around, I said, "Donald Wolf, I'm Sergeant Boxer, SFPD. We need to have a word with you about your recent grand theft auto." I put Wolf against the wall and frisked him. As I dealt with Wolf, Valdin threw a wild roundhouse punch at Conklin. Conklin blocked it, and Valdin threw another, putting his full weight into it. This time, Conklin ducked, then landed an uppercut to Valdin's chin that made the big guy stagger backward into the doggy diner stand. Tin panels rattled. The vendor squawked. Conklin twisted Valdin's arms around his back and clapped on the cuffs, saying, "Ralph Valdin, you're under arrest for assault on a police officer." No one thought either Wolf or Valdin was one of the Wicker House shooters, but there was every chance they knew who had executed the seven men inside. If the shooters were Windbreaker cops, we might have a clue that would help us solve the armed robberies of the check cashing stores and the Mercados, and the shakedowns and shootings of drug dealers all over the city. I couldn't wait to get these two into the box. "Hands behind your back," I said to Wolf. That was when he decided to make a break for it. Chapter 44. Ralph Valdin was winded, cuffed, and newly docile. But Donald Wolf had taken a split second of opportunity, tucked his bag under his arm, and run for his life. He tore off past the doggy diner, the Portwalk pizza stand, and the coffee cart, through a group of fans, knocking them over like bowling pins. Wolf was small, and he was fast. While I stood with Valdin and called for backup, Wolf gave Conklin a workout, vaulting over seats, stiff-arming spectators as he wildly searched for an exit. Wolf had reached the lower rows of the stadium when Conklin tackled him. My partner got a cheer from all the fans in that entire section as he dragged Wolf to his feet and shoved him back up the steps to where I stood with Valdin at the hot dog concession.
"You have the right to remain silent," Conklin said to Wolf. "Anything you say can be used against you, jerk-off."
Wolf said,
"I gotta call my girl. You gonna hold that against me in a court of law?"
Wolf is what's called a real smartass. There was no fear in his face at all. And there should have been. He was in trouble. I pulled his duffel bag away from him and unzipped it. There was an astonishing amount of money inside, maybe 50,000 in neatly banded used bills. "I'll hold this for you," I said to Wolf, "until you can produce your pay stub." Meanwhile, we had attracted some attention at the doggy diner. The fans were pumped up and buzzed, and now some of them were turning on my partner and me. Oh, I really love the sound of drunken a-holes yelling, "Hey, they didn't do anything wrong. It's a free country, isn't it? We're all just watching a ball game. What's the damn problem?" The backup I'd called for was on the way, and stadium security was trotting directly toward us. I said to the hecklers, "Anyone feel like joining our party? Because we've got plenty of room at the jail."
"Police brutality, that's what this is," said a beefy young bruiser showing off for his girlfriend. "I saw it," he insisted. "I'm going to report you. What's your badge number?"
The girlfriend and others were pointing their phones in my face and at my badge. And you know what? I finally got mad. I shouted to the security guards, "Cuff these people, this one, these two, and her. I'm taking you all in for interference with the police, for obstruction, for being drunk and disorderly." Hecklers fell back, but not before we had four of them in flex cuffs and were marching them out to the cruisers at the gates. 2 hours later, at 12:30 dinner time, the night shift was parking at their desks in the squad room. Ralph Rascal Valdin was in holding, and Conklin and I were set to interrogate Donald Francis Wolf in Interview 1. Chapter 45. I hadn't eaten anything but a burger and a stack of pickle chips since Brady's surprise visit at 6 that morning. I was irritable and frustrated, and now Conklin and I were in the box with Donald Wolf, who didn't act like a man who was going down for a felony.
"Do you understand you're on the hook for a felony?"
Conklin asked him.
"I didn't do nothing."
"You tackled me, that's assault, yo. with a deadly weapon on your person. I got witnesses. I didn't know you were a cop, and that's why I ran.
Conklin yawned. Then he said,
For the record, Sergeant Boxer announced that she was a police officer and showed you her badge. I'm a witness. Sergeant, I'll be back.
Conklin got out of his chair and left the interview room. Generally, Conklin took the role of good cop, but right now he was keeping his powder dry for Valdin. So I took over the interview with Wolf. Donald, I said. Okay for me to call you Donnie?
Donnie is okay, he said.
He was 25. He had a sixth grade education. He had done small time and had had a lot of experience in rooms just like this one. Look, Donnie, we've got you on boosting the Honda. Got you cold. I'm going to say you didn't find that big bag of money under a bench at a streetcar stop.
Funny you say that, Sergeant. That's right. Bench outside the ferry terminal. You got a report of that money being stolen? No, right? It's all mine.
I acted like he hadn't said anything. Grand Theft Auto is going to get you 12 to 15.
For that beater? It's an 07, and I didn't steal it anyway.
Found it at the ferry terminal?
Yes, ma'am. Man said to me, take this car from me, please. I can't afford to have it fixed. I gave one large in cash, and he said thanks.
I picked up the rather thick file of Donald Wolf's record of juvenile and petty crimes and slammed it down hard on the table. It made a nice loud crack. I said,
cut the shit.
You want a break on that stolen car, you've got exactly 1 minute to help me out. After that, my partner is getting what we need from Valdin. He looks soft, Donnie. I'm betting he's gonna step up to the line. Wolf looked down at the table and started shaking his head while muttering,
No.
Know what, Donnie?
What is it you want to know exactly?
What do you know about the armed robbery at Wicker House this morning?
N-O, nothing. When I left work, everything was cool. Do you understand? Rascal and me, we're stockroom boys. We unpack the boxes, we ship boxes out, we make labels and check inventory, and sometimes we bring coffee to some decorator lady. I don't know shit about shit.
Did you know there was going to be a raid on Wicker House?
How would I know anything about that?
7 people were shot to death. You knew those men, Donnie. You worked with them. You want whoever killed them to get away with it?
I hope you get whoever did that. I do.
He looked at me like I was supposed to believe him. I said, do you know anything about men wearing police windbreakers knocking over Mercados? Hitting up drug dealers?
What? Cops taking drugs and money off of dealers and keeping it for themselves? I never heard of anything like that.
He laughed. Then he got serious. He leaned across the table and said,
Listen up, Sergeant. Other people will take care of this problem that happened at Wicker House, okay? They're a whole lot better at it than you.
That stopped me. Meaning what? Who's going to take care of this? How? Wolf shrugged. His flip, phony, wise-ass personality was back.
Follow the money, Sergeant.
Explain what you mean by that, I said. He said,
I get my phone call now? My girlfriend is worried about why I'm not home. Did I say we're having a baby?
Who will get to kiss his daddy in 12 to 15? I left the room and walked next door. I looked through the glass into interview 2 and watched Conklin get absolutely nowhere with Ralph Valdin. Another stockroom boy. Didn't know nothing. 7 men had died, and if that massacre was over wicker furniture, it was a first. More likely, big money and a lot of drugs had been boosted from that drug factory. I thought about what Wolf had said in that one honest-sounding statement. Someone would take care of the men responsible. Someone better at it than us. Follow the money. I had a shivery feeling as I thought about what kind of payback there might be for the massacre at Wicker House. A feeling the Irish might express by saying, Someone just walked over my grave. Chapter 46. Cindy was being treated like a celebrity in a bookstore called Book Review on Long Island, New York. This part, the book signings, the people applauding her. She hadn't thought about this at all during the years she'd spent thinking about writing a book. She had staked out psycho killers in sketchy areas, had spent nights in rough motels or in her car, had worked nights and weekends and pestered cops, even ones she loved, for information that would become a great story, possibly an exclusive one. She had worked the crime desk for the challenge of finding an angle that the police didn't have, for the rush of turning her hand-mined facts into dramatic prose. It had been a non-stop thrill, and now there was this. In a time when bookstores were going virtual, this one was what a real bookstore still looked like in her dreams. There was a blue and white checked floor, thousands of linear feet of bookshelves, comfortable nooks for people to sit and read in, and an inviting performance space where writers could give readings and sign books. The owner of Book Review, Bob Klein, was coming over to talk to her now. Bob was a good-looking man in his 50s wearing glasses, a starched shirt, and a smart tan suit.
"Cindy, I've got open cartons under your table. I'll test the microphone for you when you're ready."
There was a rope line leading to a table with a blow-up of her picture on an easel behind it, and another easel holding a poster of her book jacket. A stack of books rested on the table with a line of pens. And people were coming into the store in response to the ad and were filling up the chairs, easily 20 women, who lit up when they recognized her from her picture. She was talking to Bob when her phone rang. Cindy answered the call and said,
"Richie, I'm at Book Review."
"Hey, sweetie, hang on."
She heard him say,
"I'll be back in a second, Mr. Valdine. Sit tight."
A door closed. Then Richie was back.
"Sorry. Got a couple of mutts could have some information on this bloodbath in a drug lab."
"You want to speak later?" Cindy said.
"No, I'm good. So how did it go, your speech?"
"I'm going on in a couple of minutes," Richie said.
"You'll do great. I know that for a fact."
Cindy sent love and kisses out to San Francisco. And then Bob said to her,
"Your fans await."
Cindy took the lectern to a nice little round of applause. There were 22 people there, her world record. She spoke into the microphone.
"Hello, everyone. So nice to see you all here. I'm Cindy Thomas, and I want to tell you about my book, Fish's Girl. Whatever you think about the love between a man and a woman, you probably never thought that serial murder could bond two people. But I'm here to tell you about Randy Fish and Mackie Morales, two savage killers and their marriage with child, which was as tight as a marriage can be."
Chapter 47. At just about midnight, one drove a white panel van packed with cartons of synthetic drugs and kilos of heroin toward a meet with a man called Spat. One had dealt with Spat before. He was a middle-aged guy, a deadly old hand and go-between for a Midwestern drug distributor. One's sole purpose tonight was to offload a few hundred pounds of drugs and take in stacks of Andrew Jackson's and Ben Franklin's. The sooner that was done, the happier he'd be. The meeting place was a residential area in West Oakland, a dodgy part of the Bay Area known for poverty and crime. Now, one crossed the Bay Bridge to Oakland, then followed the sign to I-980 West in downtown Oakland, obeying the speed limit and signaling for every turn. Last thing in the world he wanted was a traffic stop. He'd done enough killing for one day. His hands were actually shaking from the trauma of firing the gun. The GPS was giving him the turns, and he easily found Sycamore Street, a desolate residential block. The houses were scabby with tar paper. The asphalt was littered and potholed, and a group of tough guys gathered on one corner, harassing one another, looking for a fight. One parked the van, then lifted the M16 from the footwell and put it on the seat next to him. He ran his finger under his collar, scratching the itch left by the pepper spray that had gotten under his mask. Time dragged its ass. Spat was late. One had half decided to pull out and arrange another meeting, another venue, when he saw a black minivan rolling toward him in the oncoming lane. The minivan parked across the street from him and flashed its headlights twice before the engine was cut. One's phone rang. He answered it, saying,
"You're late."
"Yeah, but you're going to thank me," said Spat. "I'm coming to see you now."
One clicked off, watching Spat get out of his minivan with a large canvas bag in hand. Then Spat spoke to him through the open window.
"How's this? I got two kids to unload the van for us. This should take no time. Check it out."
One took the bag of money through the open window and said,
"Not that I don't trust you."
"No problem, brother. I'll be right over there," Spat said.
When Spat was back in his vehicle, One undid the fasteners on the satchel and riffled through the packets of money. A lot of phony money was circulating these days, and it was common in swaps like these for fake bucks to get into the stacks. He opened some of the bands, fanned out the bills, and turned on a UV light, looking for signs that the bills were counterfeit. At the same time, he did a first count, arrived at the agreed-upon $1.2 million. He counted a second time, then repacked the bag and called Spat's phone. The two men exchanged a few words. The minivan started up, then did a U-turn and parked behind One's panel van. One pulled the lock release, and Spat opened the cargo doors and checked out the drugs in the same way One had checked out the money. Carefully. When Spat was satisfied, the two young men in his employ moved the cartons efficiently to Spat's minivan, then got back inside it. The transaction was completed quickly. Spat came around to the driver's side of the panel van and said to One,
"Talk on the street about some mayhem in a furniture store."
"That right?"
One said.
"I haven't heard."
"Okay, my friend. Vaya con Dios."
"Stay in touch," said One.
It was a cool night, but One was sweating. The Wicker House drugs had reportedly been paid for and were on the way to Kingfisher. He'd expected there would be talk on the street,
as long as no one knew who he was.
The gangsters on the corner shouted something at him as he drove past. He gave them the finger before he realized they had only shouted,
"Lights!"
He switched on his headlights, got onto the freeway, and headed home. He'd earned a good night's sleep. He hoped he could get one. Chapter 48. Two men sat in a darkened car on Texas Street, two houses in from the corner of 18th, one block away from a commercial strip. Potrero Hill was a pretty area with a view of the bay from higher on the hill, but lower, in front, all you could see were the facades of the somewhat run-down Victorian houses, the intermittent trees, and the rat's nest of telephone wires overhead. The guys in the car were watching one house in particular, a quaint, middle-class house that was light green with dark green trim, fronted with a short brick wall and a walk of cement pavers leading up to an unpainted wood panel front door. At about midnight, a silver Camry backed into a spot between a couple of scruffy trees. The man who got out of the car was white and had dark hair with a balding spot at the back of his head. He was wearing a dark blue SFPD windbreaker. As he locked up his car, his phone rang. He leaned against his car and spoke and listened. Then he pocketed his phone, walked up to the front door, and let himself in with his keys. Lights went on in the downstairs hallway and then the kitchen. Those two lights went out, and another went on in the second story in a front room, probably a bedroom. Within the next half hour, the only light in the house was the blue light from the TV. And then the TV went off, too. One of the men in the car said to the other,
"I've never liked these old houses. I look at them, all I see is maintenance. When you have a family, you like a deck in back, a yard, barbecue and whatnot. Christ, how long we've been waiting here."
"Take it easy," said the first man.
"After we say hello to Inspector Calhoun and his family, we can go get something to eat." "I'm way ready," said the second man. "You sure you don't want to sit here and count stars?"
The second man scoffed. One of them was going to take the front door, while the other went to the back.
"See you inside," said the first man. "Don't get anything on you," said the second man.
They both adjusted their guns
and got out of the car. Chapter 49. I was awoken out of a heavy sleep by my husband saying,
"Lindsay, honey, wake up."
But why? I heard no shrieks or alarms or barks, no wails or any other emergency sounds. I was in bed, and the light in the bedroom was dawn-like, so why was Joe waking me up? Then my eyelids flew open. "Where's Julie?"
"Julie is fine. Everything is okay, honey."
I rolled over onto my side and scanned Joe's face for whatever was behind his waking me up when I needed to sleep. He was smiling.
"What time is it?"
7, he said.
"Is it Saturday?"
I asked him.
"Yes. We're going for a drive. You, me, and baby makes 3. And Martha makes 4.
"I can't go," I said.
"The car is gassed up. I'm going to feed Julie. Coffee is on. Just get yourself up and leave the surprise part to me."
I blinked at Joe, thinking how pretty much everyone in the Southern Station was working the weekend on the helter-skelter case of the Windbreaker cops. Still, he was right. I needed a little time to recharge. I texted Brady that I was taking a mental health day. He got right back.
"Really?"
"It's just for the day."
"Okay. I'll buddy up with Conklin."
A half hour later, the Molinari 4 were in Joe's lovely old Mercedes, heading down the coast. Highway 1 hugs the shoreline, and I was reminded once again how gorgeous California is. I'm not saying I stopped thinking about the Windbreaker cops, but I shook the case off long enough to call my sister Kat. We made a pit stop in Half Moon Bay, where my sister lives with her 2 daughters. Pretty soon, the little girls were romping with Martha on the beach, and we grown-ups lagged behind them, catching up on missed chapters in each other's lives and marveling at the way the sun lit the coastline.
"You doing okay, Linz?"
Kat asked me.
"Yeah, sure. Like usual, a little preoccupied. How about you?"
"When a princely frog appears, it will all be perfect." We grinned at each other. I, for one, was thinking about when Joe and I got married here in Half Moon Bay not long ago. My sister and I held hands, and the girls hugged and kissed me, after which the Molinari family piled back into the car and continued in a southerly direction. Martha sat on my lap and hung her head out the window. The baby slept in her carrier behind us. Joe sang along with the radio.
It was kind of marvelous.
We reached our lunch destination, Shadow Brook Restaurant, which is built into the side of a hill overlooking SoCal Creek. And the best part, the part that made our little kiddo squeal, was the cable car that traveled down from the parking lot to the restaurant so that you could see the tropical gardens and waterfalls outside the glass. Joe was quite animated over lunch. He'd been working on the case he called CBM, Claire's Birthday Murders. He had mined and sieved the databases looking for intersecting lines between stabbings of women in San Francisco on May 12th, as well as murders, bank robberies, domestic violence, and more traffic accidents than I would have thought possible. But still, even with his giant brain and investigatory genius, plus access to law enforcement databases, he'd come up with no hard evidence connecting the incidents to an actual suspect. But you know what? Our minds were sharp. We had the space to talk and turn ideas over, to compare what we'd already confirmed about the 5 women who'd been stabbed to death in San Francisco on May 12th in sequential years. Namely, the women were strangers to one another. None of the crimes had been witnessed or solved, and no serious suspects had even been questioned. We had made progress by the process of elimination, and Joe and I were even more firmly convinced that the 5 CBMs on our list had all been done by the same guy. Something had tripped off that killer 5 years ago and sent him on an anniversary spree. Unless his fury had run its course, he was still free and highly likely to kill again. Chapter 50. On the way home, Joe dropped me off at Susie's Cafe. Susie's is the Women's Murder Club Clubhouse, where Cindy, Claire, Yuki, and I get together more or less weekly to brainstorm our cases, to bitch about the lumps life hands out, and of course to celebrate good news, both tiny and huge, over hot Caribbean food and cold beer on tap. I blew kisses to Joe, then turned toward the bright light coming through Susie's windows and the faint plinking sound of steel drums, which got louder when I opened the front door. Hot tea was warming up, and regulars at the bar waved as I walked through the main room, down the narrow corridor past the kitchen, and into the back room, where Claire and Yuki were waiting at our cozy red leather booth. Claire was telling Yuki something that required vigorous use of her hands, and Yuki was listening intently as I slid in beside her. I got and gave a couple of good hugs, and Claire said, "I'm telling Yuki about this stinking case I got." "Catch me up," I said. I signaled to Lorraine that I needed beer, and Claire said to me, "Yesterday morning, EMTs bring in this 8-year-old girl. The one in charge says Mom's story is that she gave the little girl a bath at 4 a.m, went to get a fresh towel, and when she came back, the little girl had drowned." I said, "A bath at 4 a.m? Claire said, "Exactly. The EMT quotes the mom as saying the little girl is hyperactive and sometimes a bath calms her down. So I'm checking out this poor little girl, and damn, there's no foam in her mouth, fingers aren't wrinkled up, the lungs do not cross at the midline, but her hair is wet. I look her over, no bruises, no nothing." Lorraine came with a glass and a pitcher of beer and said, "Lindsay, I recommend the coconut shrimp with rice." I told her I was up for that, and Yuki and Claire said, "Me too," in unison. Then Claire went on, "I give her the full body x-rays, and they're fine. No broken bones, and I send her blood to the lab, and it comes back negative for drugs or poison." Yuki said, "What the hell? She had something viral? Bacterial?"
"Nope," said Claire.
"I checked. But when I'm doing the internal exam, I find pizza in the little girl's stomach." We all pondered that bit of information for a few moments. Then Lorraine brought the food. We all sat back as the plates were set down, and Yuki said, "Don't stop now, Claire, go on."
"Okay, hang on," said Claire.
She sampled the shrimp and rice, swallowed some beer, dabbed at her lips, and said,
"So I call Wayne Yuvrard. You know him, Lindsay. Vice, Northern District. He finds out that Mom's got a sheet for prostitution, and now this whole 4 a.m. bath and pizza story is just grabbing me all wrong. And I still don't know what killed this little girl. So I ask Yuvrard to have Mom come in for a chat. And he does and tells me she comes in to see him wearing a new outfit, has her face on and her hair done. And he says to her, 'What happened to your baby?' And he's pretty sure she's going to say she drowned. But instead, he tells me, Mom takes a deep breath and squeals the deal. She says, 'I had an out call, steady customer, and I needed the money. Anita has a seizure disorder but hardly has seizures anymore, and when she does, we just leave her on the floor and she gets over it.' Mom goes on to tell Yuvrard that Anita must have gotten up and eaten something and then had a seizure because she was dead on the floor when Mom came home from her call. And Mom decides if she leaves her there and calls the police, they'll take her kids away. So she put her daughter in the tub and called 911. And I thought, Christ, they'd be right to take away her children. She's irresponsible, maybe criminally negligent. And I say to Yuvrard, 'Did she say, if only I had stayed home, my daughter would be alive?' And Yuvrard said, 'Nope, nothing like that. I saw no remorse at all.' So I write Anita up as probable seizure disorder, manner of death natural." I said, "You're going to let this lady slide?" Claire said, "That's up to the prosecutor, but Inspector Yuvrard did book her on child endangerment resulting in a homicide." Claire stabbed a shrimp with her fork, held it up, and said, "And that's how we close cases in the medical examiner's office."
Claire's delivery was priceless, and Yuki spat out her beer, and yes, this was a bad story, but it was good to hear Yuki's merry bells laughter, which I hadn't heard in a while. And, of course, that was when my phone rang.
"Sorry to interrupt your day off," Conklin said.
"What's up?"
"Tom Calhoun."
"Calhoun who's working with us on the Mercado shooting?"
"Yeah," said Conklin.
His voice sounded terrible.
"Calhoun and his whole family. They were murdered."
Chapter 51. I apologized to my girlfriends and tried to pick up the check, but they objected, hugged me, and watched me go. Conklin met me at the curb in his Bronco, PDQ. I got into the passenger seat and buckled up. He turned on the siren and we sped toward Potrero Hill, revving over the slopes and slamming the undercarriage on the downhill drops. There were only a few streaks of light left in the sky when we got to Potrero, but I knew this neighborhood in the dark, knew it cold. I had lived a few streets over from the murder house until a few years ago, when my own house burned to the ground. We turned off 18th Street onto Texas, which looked like a Saints Day street festival. Lights blazed from every window on the block, and strobes flashed from dozens of law enforcement vehicles crowding the street. After parking between two CSU vans, Conklin and I badged the unis at the barricade between the street and yard, ducked under the tape, and took the short walk up to the front of the two-tone green Victorian house. When we got to the front steps, I saw vomit on the foundation plantings and that the doorknob and lock assembly had been shotgunned out of the door. Charlie Clapper met us on the doorstep. Even on the weekend, he dressed impeccably. His hair was freshly combed, the creases in his pants were crisp, and his jacket looked like it had just come from the cleaners. But Charlie looked stunned.
"This is as bad as it gets," he said.
Clapper is director of the forensics unit at Hunter's Point, but before he took over the CSU, he was a homicide cop. A very good one. Top dog at a crime scene, he does a first-class job without grandstanding or getting in our way. I was about to ask him to run the scene for us when Ted Swanson came out of the kitchen, shaking his head and looking pale and as shocked as if one of his arms had been ripped off. He moaned,
"This is fucked up."
Conklin and I gloved up, slipped booties over our shoes, and entered the kitchen, where we saw the formerly animated robbery cop, Tom Calhoun. Calhoun was naked, duct-taped to a kitchen chair. He'd been beaten up so badly I wouldn't have recognized him but for his bald spot. There was no doubt in my mind. He'd been tortured for a good long time by professionals. All of his fingers had been broken. His soft, white underparts had been burned with cigarettes. His eyelids had been sliced off. And finally, probably mercifully, he'd been shot through his temple.
"He didn't go fast," said Swanson, who was standing behind us. "Those fucks cut up Marie, too, before they shot her."
Clapper said, "Marie was found lying over there by the stove. She's on her way to the morgue."
Conklin asked about the kids, and Swanson said,
"Butch and Davy were asleep when they were shot, looks like. I don't think they knew anything, right, Charlie?"
Clapper said, "I'd have to agree with you there. They didn't wake up."
"I knew these people," Swanson said. "I had dinner here last week. What the hell was the point of this?"
He began to cry, and I put a hand on his arm and told him how sorry I was. Swanson's partner, Vasquez, came into the kitchen saying,
"Sergeant, the second floor is off limits. CSI is dusting everything. We should all get out of here and let these people work."
Chapter 52. I told Vasquez and Swanson we'd catch up to them later. But first, I wanted to chat with Clapper. The front door opened and closed, and Conklin and I were alone in a brightly lit living room with CSIs taking pictures, dusting for prints, and swabbing for trace. Conklin and I had to piece all this into a narrative that made sense. Something that would explain what now seemed inexplicable. Conklin said,
"What do you think happened here, Charlie?"
"My opinion?"
A couple of guys wanted something, and they were willing to torture and murder 4 people in order to get it, he said. What did they want? Don't know. Did they get it? Don't know that either. It wasn't a robbery. Nothing was tossed. There's small cash and jewelry on the dresser in the bedroom. He didn't have to tell us to be careful. We followed in his footsteps as he showed us that the lock had been shot off the back door as well as the front. That told us that at least 2 shooters were involved. Dr. Germaniuk, the medical examiner on call, came back into the house and said he was taking Tom Calhoun to the ME's office now if that was okay. Clapper said, "Go ahead. We got what we need." Then Clapper said to my partner and me, "The wife had duct tape residue on her wrists and ankles and across her mouth, so she'd also been taped to a chair. I'm guessing she was cut loose and beaten while her husband was still alive and watching." I said, "Oh my God," a few times, and Conklin looked like he wanted to punch the wall. I asked Clapper to go on. "Here's how it probably went down," Clapper said. "The family was upstairs, probably asleep. The doers shot out the locks and entered. Calhoun probably came downstairs."
"He had to be armed," I said.
"His 9 was found in the living room, fully loaded. The gun is bagged and ready to go to the lab."
"So Calhoun comes down the stairs with his gun," I said. "He didn't shoot?"
"He was outgunned, outmanned. I think he tried to negotiate. I imagine he told the perps, 'Get out, nothing's happened yet,' something like that. The doers maybe turned it around on him."
Conklin said, "Like, come into the kitchen and let's talk, we'll leave your family alone?"
"Yeah," Clapper said. "Something like that. Then maybe the wife comes down the stairs."
Conklin said, "Right. They take the gun from Calhoun, move him and his wife into the kitchen."
"Oh, man," I said, visualizing the scene, the terror. I saw the shooters telling the Calhouns to get undressed. She has to duct tape her husband to the chair. Then one of the shooters does the same to her. Putting the next part of it together in my mind, I figured Mrs. Calhoun was tortured to motivate Calhoun to give them what they wanted. What did they want? Did Calhoun have it? We followed Clapper upstairs to the bedrooms and saw the blood-drenched sheets in the bunk beds where the 2 boys had been shot in their sleep. They were now in body bags on the way to the morgue with their parents. My partner and I stood in the open front doorway with lights flashing red and blue behind us and thanked Charlie for the tour. He didn't have to say, "Get these bastards," and I didn't say, "Call us if you learn anything." We all knew what we had to do. Calhoun's death was job 1. Every cop in the Hall of Justice would be on this until the Calhoun's killers were found. The work would go on all night, and it would continue until it was over. But there was nothing for my partner and me to do in this house. Not tonight. Chapter 53. When I walked into our apartment and kicked off my shoes, Jimmy Fallon was on the tube, and I no longer felt like the same woman who'd spent the day with wind-blown dog ears in my face, who had walked and talked with my sister and nieces, who had cuddled with my husband and baby, laughed over Nouvelle Cuisine, and slugged down beer with 2 of my best friends. I briefed my husband on the aftermath of the torture and murder of a cop I knew, and his family, and gratefully accepted a glass of wine and a neck rub. Then I got on the phone. My first call was to Dr. G, followed by a conference call with Brady and Conklin. After that, I called Ted Swanson, who was not only emotionally involved, but had also been part of the robbery division team working the Windbreaker cop case with Vasquez and Calhoun. When I had all the available information, I called Jacoby, our chief, my dear friend and former partner, and brought him up to the minute. He already knew parts of the Calhoun tragedy, but I gave him a few details he didn't know. A roll of garbage bags had been left on the kitchen counter, I told Jacoby. I think the perps changed their clothes and took their bloody ones with them, along with their cigarette butts, shell casings, and sharp instruments. Jacoby said,
"So, let me guess. No prints, no DNA."
"Nothing yet," I said. Jacoby used strings of expletives in combinations I'd never heard before. The gist of the F-bombs was that all the freaking over-the-top TV crime shows had taught the freaking criminals what not to freaking do. They knew a few things from experience, I said. It was a very buttoned-up operation. I let Jacoby rant for a while, then told him goodnight, and when I finally hit the sheets, I couldn't sleep. I was organizing the case in my mind, getting ready for the squad meeting in the morning, doing all that thinking while lying with my head on my husband's chest, listening to him sleep. My thoughts circled in and around the Calhoun house, where people had been sleeping in their beds. I had a bad fantasy of the same guys breaking into our nest on Lake Street. I heard locks being shot off doors. In this bad fantasy, I got my hands on my gun, but it wouldn't fire. My fantasy didn't go any further, thank God. But sleep became an impossible dream. When Julie woke up at 3, I walked her around the living room and looked out at the street below to see if anyone was lurking in an idling car. At 6, I took Martha for a quick run, and by 7:15, I was at my desk in the homicide bullpen. Conklin arrived a few minutes later. He hung his jacket behind his chair and said,
"I had a dream."
I looked up at him. He wasn't kidding.
"I woke up thinking there's a connection between what happened to Calhoun and the Wicker House shootings."
"What was the connection?" I asked.
"I'm still thinking about it."
"Okay," I said. "Your subconscious is making a link. Probably from all the dead bodies, all the blood."
"Probably," my partner said. "But there is something sticky about those two things together."
Just then, Richie got a call from Cindy, and then a ragged-looking Brady dropped by our desks. He said to me,
"At 8 o'clock. You can brief everyone, right?"
"No problem." The squad room filled with cops. Some sat behind their desks, others parked themselves in spare chairs, and more cops stood 3 deep at the back. The room was packed with the day shifts from homicide, narco, and robbery. Swanson and Vasquez stood at the front of the room with me, and I introduced them. Then I told about 60 of my fellow officers what we knew about what had gone down in the green Victorian house on Texas Street. Brady gave out assignments. And then we went to work. Chapter 54. Conklin and I brought Swanson and Vasquez into interview too. When we all had coffee in front of us and were settled in, I started by saying, "I can only guess at how rotten you feel. We need everything and anything that could help us with the Calhoun murders. Anything you may have heard or surmised about enemies, disagreements, contacts with informants, shady business dealings, a fight over a parking spot, it doesn't matter how unlikely it might seem to you." Swanson stopped me from going on. He said,
"We get it, Boxer. You ask, we answer. You need a handle on this, and we're counting on you."
Conklin checked that the camera was on, then sat down next to me, saying,
"We're recording this, just because."
Vasquez clenched his fists and said,
"Calhoun wasn't dirty. He was a good person. He was a good cop."
I nodded, and Conklin said,
"Tell us whatever you know about him. We'll ask questions as they come up."
Swanson sighed and said, "Calhoun transferred in from L.A. Vice about 2 years ago with a good reputation. He was partnered with Kyle Robertson, who joined robbery, don't remember when offhand, but before that he was in uniform since the flood. You should talk to Robertson, they were close."
I nodded. We were seeing Robertson in a little while.
Vasquez said,
"Calhoun was a good kid. He wanted to do good in the job. If I had to fault him, I would say he was a little bit overenthusiastic."
"Meaning what?" I asked.
"He could be seen as not taking things as seriously as an older guy with more years on the job. Or maybe he wasn't hardened yet. Whatcha call it? He wasn't jaded. Either way, Calhoun had a future on the force."
Conklin asked,
"How'd his mood been lately? Was anything bothering him?"
"I didn't notice anything," said Swanson. "Did anyone have it out for him?" I asked.
Anyone he may have busted?
Swanson said, when I had dinner at their house last Wednesday, he was in a good mood. He was talking about Little League and how he and Marie were saving up for the boys' college in a 529 fund. Regular dinner talk. With photos.
The interview went on for another half hour. By the time the empty coffee containers were in the trash, I had a few leads to follow up, and no connections that would explain why Calhoun had been tortured or what anyone could have wanted from him. Conklin and I met with the long-timer, Calhoun's partner, Kyle Robertson. Along with Calhoun, we'd met Robertson during the canvass after Maya Perez had been killed. Robertson was maybe 50, but he looked older. His face was heavily lined, and his hair was gray, thin, combed over. He was eager to help, but could only say he was torn up by the killings. That nothing Calhoun had ever said to him would lead him to think he had anything worth killing him for.
"It's a complete mystery," Robertson said. "I can't make a thing out of it."
Conklin said,
"Narco has been working some street crimes, looking for some cops who might be taking money and drugs off dealers. Could Calhoun have been a part of that?"
Robertson shook his head vigorously.
"He was just a regular guy. If he hadn't become a cop, he could have been a firefighter or a high school coach. I never heard him talk about money. He smoked cigarettes, but that's the only addiction he had. Ask me, this bloodbath was entirely senseless. Maybe the killers went to the wrong house and killed the wrong people. Crazier things have happened."
Chapter 55. Conklin and I went to Brady's office with our fat notepads and thin theories. We had interviewed the Calhouns' neighbors, who had been sleeping last night when the Calhouns were being tortured and shot. They'd seen nothing and heard nothing, and were completely shocked and very frightened. We had also interviewed cops who'd worked with Calhoun, and they too were in utter disbelief. Calhoun was a good cop. He loved his job, maybe too much. They chalked that up to his youth and romantic nature. We told Brady that the three cops who knew him best, Swanson, Vasquez, and Robertson, had no clue as to why he and his family would have been tortured and slain. Brady listened to what we told him, then said,
"Here's where I'm at. In the last 2 weeks, there have been more robbery and narcotics-related homicides than in the entire last year."
He put a piece of paper on the desk and turned it, so Conklin and I could see his handwritten list of the crimes that had taken place in our division in the last 2 weeks. Brady stabbed the list as he read it out loud. "The first two check cashing store holdups, one fatality. A Mercado robbery with a murdered shop owner. Another check cashing store holdup, and this time there are three dead would-be robbers in SFPD windbreakers. Turns out they're not cops. They're idiots. Copycats who've heard about the windbreaker cops but don't know how to pull off any kind of robbery. Here, a takedown of a drug factory, seven dead. Possible sighting of a windbreaker cop. This is from narcotics," Brady said. "Six drug dealers that they know about have been shot and robbed in crack houses and on the street. The word is that cops are doing it. It's a random pattern, but a pattern nonetheless."
Conklin and I nodded like bobbleheads. Brady went on. "Probably a shitload of drugs was stolen from Wicker House. Could have been worth millions. Somebody could be in a rage about that. Makes me think an organized crew has put on SFPD windbreakers as an inside joke. And the joke is working. The crew disguises themselves as cops, and they're into drug house takedowns and cash-rich robbery opportunities. It's almost like this is an act of war. Cops versus drug thugs. And I wonder if Kingfisher is somehow involved in this. He has his fingers in everything. He can be very violent. Read up on him. Sickening stuff. Torture for fun. Sadism. Keep Kingfisher in mind."
Kingfisher was a notorious drug lord, said to be based in Southern California, though no one knew for sure. But evidence of his manufacturing and distribution enterprise was widespread. Was this big-time player somehow involved in small-time takedowns in San Francisco?
Brady wasn't done. He pushed his fingers through his hair. He looked at his computer screen and pressed some keys. I thought maybe he'd forgotten about us. But then he was saying,
"Maybe I'm just trying to make sense of unrelated incidents by making lists, turning the pieces around, hoping they'll fit. Or maybe there's something happening here that we can't quite see. We don't stop until we know."
Part 2. Chapter 56. Courtroom 5A was small, paneled in cherry wood with matching cherry benches, tables, and chairs. The judge had turned to speak to his clerk. Behind him was the golden seal of the state of California, flanked by two flags, the Stars and Stripes, and the California state flag. The room was full, but court was not yet in session. Yuki and her second chair, Natalie Futterman, sat behind their counsel table. Yuki skimmed the notes in front of her, rehearsing her opening lines in her mind like a mantra. Beside her, Natalie whispered, "I can't wait." Yuki said, "I can. I may be a pit bull, but he's a lion, Nat, an angry one." Natalie said,
"New thought for a new day."
"Do not tweet that," Yuki said.
Yuki wished she felt as excited as Natalie. Her eager second chair was a 46-year-old recent graduate of law school. Her kids were out of the house. Her husband had left her. And Natalie finally had the degree in law she'd put off 25 years ago. She was sharp, bookish, organized, had passed the bar on the first try, and was ready for prime time. Or as Natalie had put it, "You can only learn so much in a classroom." Natalie had nothing to lose but her novice status. Yuki, on the other hand, had a pretty substantial reputation at stake, and if she lost this case, she would be known for it. Cordell v. City of San Francisco. Yuki Castellano. She sued the SFPD, and they destroyed her. Across the aisle, the defense looked calm as still waters. Len Parisi, Red Dog himself, filled the chair on the aisle. Sitting next to him were two partners from Morehouse and Rogers, one of whom was the legendary Collins Rappaport as second chair. Parisi, as co-counsel to the law firm, would be first chair, and he would be doing hand-to-hand combat with her. Yuki had dressed in red today. It was a big color that required big action. You couldn't equivocate in red. You had to go for the jugular, and that was her plan. Strike first, strike hard. Natalie wore almost matching black separates, a jacket and pants that had probably come from a consignment shop 20 years before. But that was okay. The two of them were representing the victims here. They were the lawyers for the poor and the unfairly persecuted, and Natalie looked the part. Parisi's suit was moss green, and made him look like a heart attack ready to happen. Yuki smiled to herself. Whatever helped her through the fight. She and Natalie had worked hard prepping for this trial and had spent 2 days just going over her opening statement. She knew what she had to do and what she had to say. If she rehearsed any more, her impassioned, true feelings for the Cordell family would sound overly rehearsed. She didn't want that. Yuki was deep in her thoughts when she felt a touch on her shoulder. She turned to see Mrs. Cordell giving her a teary smile. Yuki squeezed her hand and smiled at the rest of the Cordell family seated behind her, about 11 people all told. Yuki was here today for them. For Bea and Mickey Cordell, and for Aaron Ray's grandfather, cousins, and friends, who were counting on her to bring justice to Aaron Ray's name. She turned to the front of the room as Judge John G. Quirk finished speaking to the clerk. She liked Judge Quirk. Despite the miserable people he'd dealt with in his 20 years on the bench, she'd found him to be kind. In chambers, he showed that he had an understanding of